Tegan.
And I'm Eric.
This is season 2 of the Professional Weaver Podcast, where each week we have discussions with weavers and the supply chain that supports us with hopes to build depth, transparency, and connection within the hand weaving community.
This week's episode was sponsored by Comfort Cloth Weaving, a company specializing in heirloom quality handwoven products for the home, as well as yardage for the fashion and accessories industries and value-added products for farmers and wool growers. Find out more at comfortclothweaving.com.
We would like to thank all of our patrons of the podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, go to proweaverpod.com/support to make a one-time or monthly support contribution. This week, we are talking with Bridget Extraordinaire of Ranu Handwoven from Oregon. Ranu Handwoven is a closed-loop production, meaning that Bridget will reuse material waste created during the production process for additional products. She begins with mill-end yarn, which is rescued from large manufacturing houses where they were destined for the landfill. That yarn is then woven by hand in the U.S. without the use of electricity, utilizing mechanical Dobby looms to create beautiful patterns and textures. Each garment is woven to size, which significantly reduces the amount of scrap left on the cutting room floor. What remains will then be transformed into additional product. A trademark of her work is that the warp threads are plied, producing a beautifully subtle gradient in the cloth. Ranu came about from the master passing along their knowledge and tools to their apprentice, continuing the weaving legacy. We hope you enjoy our conversation with Bridget as we talk about her apprenticeship, pricing, what it takes to create a new line of wearables, and more.
We began talking to Bridget about how she found her way to weaving through her community.
Yeah, so I got into weaving 5 years ago, I guess, 2015. It was not at all on my radar. I was into textile things, working with my hands, always, you know, been a maker artist person. And I had have a friend and like extended like spiritual community member who had been building a weaving business for about a decade. And he was starting to have some like chronic pain stuff and was like looking forward towards like retiring from weaving and picking up and starting a new arts business. And he put out a call to our like greater community for an apprentice.
Oh, cool.
And he and I have, he's a special person, and we have personalities that I thought could work well together. So I went for it, and
cool.
I apprenticed with him for 2 years and basically did all of his production. Like we did the, I learned his process in steps, but did his production for a couple of years while he was building a new business.
Oh, cool.
And then at the end of 2 years, which we thought was going to be longer because we had sort of, we had mapped out, sort of like a sweat equity buy-in. And then that wasn't moving as fast as he wanted. So he was like, well, why don't we just like do what we've been doing? And at the end of this time frame, we'll just call it good. It's like,
whoa.
And then I inherited every piece of his business.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
pretty wild.
That's awesome. It's really kind of special when somebody has like built this business up and then take you under their wing and then be like, you know what? I trust you. This is what we want to do. You can carry this torch forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really special.
It so
what,
pretty cool.
What kind mm-hmm. of stuff were you weaving before? And then how has that translated into your work now?
Yeah. So, I mean, his business was pretty successful. And he was doing, he has one design. It's like a hooded cloak with some fringe on the bottom. And he had a great customer base, and was like taking that to different art fairs and like some music festivals and stuff like that. Some like decent circuit type stuff. So I kept that design also because when I jumped into the thing, I didn't have a lot of time to develop my own line of things or like develop my own voice even really.
Yeah.
Cause I was reproducing his work. Right. And I inherited that design. So for the first, I guess, year and a half, I was doing just that. And I was bringing that to shows and actually got into a couple of shows that he had applied to for a number of years and never got into, which felt great.
Ooh, nice.
Which he was, of course, really happy about. And then I was like using my first step into developing my own voice was to take the cloth design and techniques that I learned from him and then do some different product designs with it.
Cool.
And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
That's cool.
But I'm working on something completely different right now, which is very exciting.
This is just a side note, but did he have a yurt?
Yeah.
I know who you're talking about.
His name's Blossom.
Yes. Uh-huh. Oh my goodness. I used to read his blog.
Yeah.
And that kind of was like one of the things like, oh, you can actually do a business weaving. Like he was such a huge influence when I was in college.
Sure. Oh, that's amazing.
That's so cool.
He was an apprentice. So it's like really, it's extra special to like be in this like lineage of apprenticeships and apprentices.
Mm. Oh, that's so great. And I'm so glad you're continuing like growing that business because those designs are beautiful. It was so timeless.
Thank you. Yeah.
So do you kind of have the same model where you take the mill ends and blend them together, or are you now sourcing new materials? Okay.
Well, I am still using his technique with the mill ends and supplying and the color gradients and all that stuff. And I'm going to keep that design and that technique because it is like the flagship design. But I want to do less of it. And I'm finding a way to integrating the mill ends and doing a really fine cloth with them and also new materials.
Cool.
I've been playing around with bamboo and raw silk.
Oh, nice.
I love raw silk.
Oh, God, I love it so much.
It has such a good, it has such a good smell after it's been finished.
Yeah.
We actually just sold out of them, raw silk blankets.
Oh, wow.
And you could tell a fiber person when they would come in and be like, can I smell this blanket? Like, they know that raw silk smell.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting, too, because that was our most expensive item in the booth. And we had four of them. And we bring them to, you know, we just carried them around for, just to have them, I got, you know, as something there. Like sort of to show off a higher end so that we could sell higher end things, like custom work and things like that. And everybody who bought one, not one person asked how much they were.
That's
amazing. Came in, they knew what it was, they wanted it. And they left it.
Super cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just relating that to experience that I've had recently, which is my newest design with this particular cloth is like a coat with pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And the two, you know, I brought just a couple of them to like the last couple shows of last year. And the two people who bought them also didn't even ask me. They're just like, I want that. And I'm like, that's $650. And they're like, yeah, wrap it up, please. And I'm like, okay.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, we can't afford our own stuff. So when other people are like, oh yeah, that's no problem. I'm like, okay, I'm not not going to sneeze at it. I'm just just accept.
Exactly.
Let it come.
Yeah. Or like when people pull out, I love when people pull out the, you know, they put a pile of stuff on the table and they pull out a card that weighs more than the fabric that they're buying, you know, and they hand it to you like thunks on the counter. That's always a good feeling too.
So what kind of inspires your new designs now? What inspires your work?
So what I'm working towards is, feel shy about talking about it, but I think it's probably time. I'm working towards like a small hand woven clothing line.
Nice.
Yeah. And I have been inspired by like brands like Ace and Jig, and, there's a new line out of Portland that I'm going to have to look up the name of right now. That's super inspiring. They're like partnering with some folks, in Oaxaca and doing like hand woven, like workwear.
Oh, whoa.
Which is super cool. What are they called? They're called Graziano and Gutierrez.
Cool.
And they're out of Portland. They just came across my radar like a couple weeks ago, but I've been thinking about this project and direction for maybe like 2.5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I finally got some sampling done and feel like I'm like working towards making it happen this year. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, that is really, that's inspirational to growing and seeing where your business is going, because that was a conversation that Eric and I had at one point, was if we went into doing hand-woven clothing, we ended up choosing not to because...
Yeah, we thought about it and researched it for about, probably a year and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we just decided, I don't have the skill set to execute, so that would have to be something that was outsourced for me. And
which part?
The sewing part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the
actual construction.
Right, the construction of the garment
mm-hmm.
part. Well, and not, I don't think not so much the design of the garment, but the technical part of designing the garment.
Sure.
Like I want it to look like this, but I don't understand how that connects or how it would have to be assembled, and then we have to bring somebody on to help us with that part, and then we have to gain that knowledge so that we can walk back down the mm-hmm. process to the weaving so that we can make a fabric that can
support
that essentially,
right?
So I think I'm
working in a different direction. Like I did a bunch of fabric sampling first and like found some things that I like, that I love the feel and the drape of.
Mm-hmm.
And then Blossom used to, his studio was in a building that was owned by a woman who was running a professional sewing business out of it. So I have connections with professional technical seamstresses. Mm-hmm. I guess they're all female, so they're seamstresses. And I also share my studio with a professional seamstress. So I'm able to like, nice. And I am going to pay her for some consulting and stuff.
Cool.
But I also don't have any of those skills. And I'm kind of feel like I'm crazy for doing it a lot of days, but it seems like it's a niche out there that is not being filled.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm just like, let's try it. Let's take a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, if you've already got products in that space.
Right. Like I'm already doing apparel and wearables, so it doesn't feel like a huge shift. It seems like a natural shift.
Yeah. It seems like a natural evolution. Too. Mm-hmm.
For us, it would have been it would have been like a totally separate line from what we're already doing.
Yeah, and I've had folks encourage me to go more of the like housewares, home collection type stuff. And for some reason, it's just not, I don't have it. I don't have the spark for it.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah. And why spend your time doing something you don't have the spark for, you know?
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we, when we started, we thought about how, we wanted to weave. That was the goal in the end, right? And we thought about how we could do that. Like, what's the easiest way into that?
Sure.
And for us in this area, we were looking at shows and what the shows that were around us we could get into for like what categories were lacking in weaving. And we found that home goods were lacking around this area. So we decided that shows we wanted to go to didn't have as many home goods in them. So we would make home goods. And Tegan loves making blankets anyway. It's like massive yardage is what she wants to do. So it was perfect in that regard. You know, warp up 50 yards and go for it.
Yeah.
So that's only how 50. We sort of decided our direction.
Cool. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the evolution of your clothing line, though. Yeah. Like, that will be really cool. Especially, are you going to tie in some of the elements from your other wearables into these clothing line? Or is it going to be a totally... I'm also might
be... totally different. Like, I love what Blossom does, and I love... I can appreciate it, but it doesn't resonate. It's not like...
It's not you.
It's not me. And I find that I think I have a hard time selling it. And I think that people have a hard time believing that it's me in the product, you know, and there's like a disconnect. Even though I believe in it 110% or whatever, you know, it's like, there's just like, they see me and they see this and they're like, I don't,
it doesn't quite jive.
So, but I think one of the elements that I want to hold on to is offering at least some kind of like bright jewel tone color, like some of that to kind of like tie things together. Cause I also understand that there needs to be a continuity of like aesthetic in a certain way. That's
cool. Yeah. Cause you struggle against, I think the thing that we all eternally struggle against is, how can I weave and make things I really love and also sell them and make money to continue weaving the things I really love. I think it's so hard. And if you've got, and it's hard to like strike that balance between the thing that you know works and sells and like putting the time towards that while also trying to develop that thing that's like deeper in you that really wants to come out and be explored.
But it's also riskier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that thing is always riskier for whatever reason.
Totally.
Yeah.
So since you took over Blossom's business and you're developing it into your own, what has kind of been a turning point for you where you feel like, I'm actually doing this? Like, this is my career. I'm making a success at it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple places. When I took ownership, on, I guess that would be January 1st, 2018. And I didn't have another job. So I went full time from the start.
Wow.
And the August previous to that was the first show that I had applied to. And it was the American Craft Council show in San Francisco. And I was accepted to their hip hop program, right? Their emerging artist program. So that definitely gave me a huge confidence, and I got like a wholesale order out of that show.
Nice.
So I had a strong start, you know, and then I did another show, just like a niche, spiritual convention thing. That I don't want to get too far into, but I had like a very successful, like a $7,000 show or something, just like right out the gate. And I haven't had that great of a show since, but it was enough to like, you know, it was enough to give me the confidence to move forward in a really solid and, in a really solid way. And then, last summer, so the summer of 2019, I decided I needed a little more stability. So I started, working a part-time like caregiving job for some family friends, that I would often, you know, need to take off from because I had shows and stuff, but it was still there and I could work it,
right,
when I needed to. And that would turned out to be the ultimate blessing because I was able to transition into doing that full time in 2020, with the cancellation of everything. So yeah. I had a part-time job that I could move into full-time and be financially stable this year.
Oh, that is a blessing.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you started, did you have a plan B, or it was just like, this is what I'm doing and I'm
this
going,
is what I'm
oh,
doing.
Yeah.
This is just what I'm doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. That was ours too. We were like, if we have a plan B, that equals an excuse to not do this.
Yeah. And like my caregiving job is not a plan B. It's like a, you know, it's a float.
Right. It's holding you until we can get back to shows.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you,
I was going to offer another moment of like,
yes,
feeling like I made it.
Yeah.
I guess, in the end of November, it was brought to my attention that, Dave Navarro had been wearing one of my pieces for the last 18 months. And, I was to make him another one.
Yes.
Like I had sold a piece to a total stranger at a show. It turned out it was for Dave Navarro, and he's been living in it for the last year and a half. And then I started communicating with Dave directly because I sent him a message just of like gratitude and a little bit of a fangirl moment, you know.
Yeah.
And now he's buying more pieces from me directly. And
that's
like
so
a whole nother level of like, okay, this is legit. This is happening. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, that's yeah. So exciting.
Yeah.
Ooh, that gave me goosebumps.
Yeah. It's so cool. Like when anybody you respect is like interested in what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Let alone somebody like
for
huge
sure.
Like that. Yeah. Damn, that's awesome. And that just totally made me forget what I was. I got too caught up in it.
Were you going to ask about shows?
Or? Yeah, because we haven't.
Oh yeah.
What was in the beginning of the podcast? We like to talk about shows a lot because we had recently been doing shows. And they had all been getting canceled, and that was like a hot topic. And then it just sort of fell off because nobody was going to shows or anything. But I'm curious, like, was that your main source of income before there was no shows?
Yeah. And I, before I started doing it, I knew that it was not what I wanted to do. But it was something that I had to do to get a foot in. And so, yeah, I don't really miss them.
So the only thing I miss is the interaction with people.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been getting that interaction with people through the podcast. And I've like been in contact with designers and other things just from mm-hmm. like being out on the web. And I kind
of... Well, we make more of a point, I think, now to reach out to wholesale clients and just say, hey, how's it going? Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't a sales call. We just want to, like, connect and say hello. And we, like, make more of a point now that we're just so disconnected from everything.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I kind of don't miss the constant drive to be producing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Being out and having a full booth every other weekend. Oof. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Because I really liked shows. I liked going to them. I liked the grind of doing a show. And when we were behind on stock, Tegan would stay home. I'd go out and do a show. You know, sure. You know, whatever it took, we figured it out. And then we couldn't go to shows anymore. And I think we both kind of remembered what it was like to not have to be out of the house every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I agree. There's that part. Because I, you know, I live in rural Southern Oregon. And so if I'm going to do a show, like I'm traveling, like there's nothing
right
local. So mm-hmm. it's a minimum of 4 hours to 4.5, I guess, to get to Portland, which isn't actually that great for shows, it turns out. So it's mostly to the Bay, you know, which is like 6.5 hours.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, that's rough. Yeah. Luckily, we've got a solid set of shows within like 3 to 5 hours.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, we got like enough that we can survive a year in mm-hmm. in that time. Some better than others, but, you know, as they are. When ACC canceled all their shows for 2021,
yeah,
I think we were just like, yeah, us too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go back. I think what we'll do is we'll go back. I'd rather be too late than too early.
Mm, when for sure.
We know that there's really people there
yeah.
and it's worth our time and money to go back.
Yeah.
We'll start going back.
Definitely.
And I'll
yeah, probably- I mean, I'm considering it a blessing. So I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to incubate this idea that I've been trying to do alongside this other thing that I've been doing. It's, I actually couldn't ask for something better, really.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, next year, 2022, I'll have a whole new line to release when we're back doing the thing.
Yeah. When everybody's like so psyched and
yeah.
they've been pent up for 2 years, you know,
exactly.
not able to do anything.
Yeah. That's kind of what we're looking forward to, is to spend this year really sampling, honing in what we want to do, making some mm-hmm. really just, like, instead of doing the production of like 50 yards of the same product, doing mm-hmm. more specialized, like maybe do a limited run of 10 blankets and a limited run of this, and just experiment with different things mm. and build our stock back up. So when we do go back, we're just ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got less stock now than we did at the beginning of the year. You know, we've been selling.
Yeah.
And that's we've great. Been creating for selling,
yeah. but
everything we've sold, we've pretty much made.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or we've yeah. sold stuff we already had. I feel like, I don't know, this year's been a weird one.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I changed about the way that I learned how to do this from Blossom, Blossom was very focused on production. This all the time. And he was very invested in carrying a large back stock and inventory mm-hmm. because there were, you know, when he was in show season, he wasn't producing at all. And then the way that I've sort of changed it has gone from away from the one of a kind model and doing like limited run things. And I'll leave, you know, when I warp a beam with a colorway, it's like, sorry, I'm looking off at my looms. You know, I'm doing like 200 yards or something, you know,
yeah.
and then it stays on that beam and I can like swap beams out. And if I get an order, you know, I can like load up a beam, crank out a few pieces while it's up there, put some stuff in inventory.
Cool.
But I've definitely like, yeah, my inventory is so slim right now. It's,
mm.
Well, that's kind of nice to have it. It's nice to have it set up where you can just kind of weave to order.
Right.
Just swap it out. And then that way you're more flexible too. You're not like, I'm stuck doing these 200 yards for the next couple months. It's
right.
More
or
like,
I have, you know, these like 20 pieces sitting in inventory, not moving for 2 or 3 years or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Cause then you've got, not only are you looking at and weaving all that yardage, the, what, you know, the red yardage that you then hate when it comes off the loom, but then you've got to finish it.
Yeah.
You know, so then it comes off and it sits there staring at you, waiting for you to finish it. And then you've got to lug it around. So by the time you get it into the bins to lug around, or it's hanging on racks, you're like, oh my God. Yeah. I just want to get rid of this. But yeah, I hear that for sure. Yeah, because
I'll just leave it on the beam and shove it in a corner somewhere and not look at it.
That's great.
Because so this year we thought about doing runs where we would do, we'd put on like maybe 50 yards of something we really like and then weave it all, like weave it off, wet finish it, and then beam it back up and then just save it and cut it and sew it to order. So like, we'd make 50 yards of a blanket and then just cut it off when somebody orders it. So,
gotcha. I mean, that's a... So you're not weaving pieces to size?
Right.
Right.
Or are you? Oh, okay. So all the things that I do, I weave to size.
Oh, okay. Cool. Mm-hmm.
So then that way you don't have to do any cutting. It's just piecing it together, right?
Yeah. Well, there's a tiny bit of cutting, but yeah, it's... cutting the different, like the garments are woven to size. And so then I'm cutting the garments apart. And then there's like a small amount of finishing sewing that happens. Cool. I weave a hood and a body piece to size and then cut them apart and do the little bit of cut and sew.
Nice.
So how many sizes do you carry in your line?
Two different lengths of the cloak and one size in the coat. And then one side, I do a like a infinity scarf cowl. I call it a cowl. And that comes in one size.
Cool. So when you get into this new line, are you thinking that you'll model it the same way? Or are you thinking that you'll have a couple of sizes?
That is the biggest challenge, right? The one thing that I really like about what I do right now, as far as clothing, is that it fits so many different types of bodies.
Yeah.
And that's really an important value to me. One of the greatest challenges of this design process is being able to maintain that value, but also not have a line of boxes.
Mm-hmm. Like, right. You want them to look stylish and chic. You don't want to just be like, here's a box. Hope you like it.
Yeah.
So there will be some sizing, and also like I'm trying to work with designs that will fluctuate with the ways that our bodies fluctuate in size.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. There's a woman in our guild who does a really good job. She's got like, I think 6 or so silhouettes.
Yeah.
Right. That she's like nailed, like perfected over years and years of making them. And she does an amazing job. She has like a couple sizes and that's all she makes.
Yeah.
And then they fit most well. Mm-hmm. She mostly sells to, I'd say like women above 30, right?
Yeah, I would say women above 30, probably upper 40s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's just like nailed it. So, mm-hmm. and she had like minimal sewing. There, some of them are like wrapped diagonally, or they're like, you know, lengths that are cut out of the whatever width she weaves. And then she'll do them diagonal, which will like leave the sleeves, like the holes for the sleeves perfect, or so she can put sleeves on or not, or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which I just am like, after we did all like of our research and thinking and looking into it, I was just like, oh, there's no way. I from my brain, for whatever reason, can't wrap around that kind of three-dimensional work.
I totally understand. Like, I, you know, when I started doing this, like, sewing is my weakest link in the process. And I thought that I hated sewing. And it turns out that I just hate plastic home sewing machines, because most of them are crap and break all the time.
Yep.
But an industrial machine is actually quite nice to work with. But yeah, I'm like, question myself and my choices in doing this all the time, because I'm just like, wow, okay, you went from hating sewing to now you're gonna sew a clothing line. All right,
sure. Well, sometimes when you're passionate about something, you kind of overlook the things that annoy you.
Yeah, for sure.
Or you just realize it's a means to
an end. Yeah,
like it's a means to seeing the fulfillment of what you've visualized.
Right.
Well, and I think you bring up a killer point with, like, getting the right equipment. I think that if you have, like, a pain point sometimes, you can attribute it to a tool, or you can fix it with a tool. If you really focus on not the fact that you hate doing this part of the process, but is there an easier way to do this?
Right.
Could I?
If you're hating something, there's probably a better way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Somebody else probably hated it more than you and made an easier way to do it.
Definitely.
Yeah. yeah, I think that's happened with us a few times. Mm. We've not even realized that what we hated about some part of a process was already fixed, and for reasonable prices, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, because one of our goals this year is getting an industrial sewing machine.
Sewing machine.
And game like changer. a good overlocking machine.
Oh yeah.
Those are two big ones on the list.
So speaking of equipment, what kind of looms are you weaving on?
Yeah, I right now have two 60-inch AVL Dobby looms set up. I could turn this computer and show you.
Yes.
So this is my studio. Ooh,
whoa.
It's huge.
Nice.
Yeah, and they are both mechanical. There's no computer Dobby. I mean, I could put the computer Dobby on there, but I don't. So
nice.
And then I have a cutting table, an industrial sewing machine, and then I found a 8 harness like jack loom on Craigslist locally. It's in fantastic shape. Because I realized that I needed to learn the basics, because I learned how to weave on the most complicated system that there is. And I found myself being like, but wait, now how do I, what do you mean you got to cross the warp? So I spent a lot of time last year doing that, teaching the basics. Because I wanted to start teaching. That was also a goal of 2020, was to start teaching. Because I get a lot of requests for it, and I'm just like, I don't know how to teach what it is that I do because of the complexity of it.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Teaching really forces you to know so much about what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause you sort of, I mean, like in the apprenticeship, you really learn, like, from somebody, you learn, like, the body movements and, like, you know, the real minutiae of what it is.
Yeah.
But it's very specific to what that person knew, you know. And if you don't have lots of mentors or people who are teaching you many different things, yeah, then you don't definitely always pick up lots of stuff.
Felt like a one-trick pony there. Yeah.
Like, yeah. So it does sometimes precipitate having to go back and and do that. I mean, that Tegan pretty much, I mean, you learned basics, right? And but then jump, like you jumped over a giant chunk of like advanced, basic, intermediate kind of level stuff into like crazy structures and things like that on ABLs and computer aided things. Whoa. And then like over the last few years have been sort of backtracking, much like you, into those more advanced beginner and intermediate type things that you need to know really when you're up here and things go wrong and you got to kind of, you know, you need the help of that intermediate stuff.
It helps to piece it together. And I know that I get frustrated with myself when I have to backtrack, but it's also made my work much stronger on the AVL. So I feel much more confident talking about it and explaining it to people that way.
Gotcha.
And I also, I frequently forget about the fact that people use crosses in their warp. And when I go back to like a regular loom, I'm just like, wait, why can't I just do this? Like,
yeah,
it's always funny when I have to sit down with an actual warp chain.
Yeah, because you're so used to just doing sectional onto the on the back room and going from there.
Yeah. So,
but one of the other motivations, other than teaching, for getting this, I think it's a jack loom, but was to do more art.
Ooh.
You know, I've been feeling inspired by some artists out there and being like, oh, I actually just need to let my brain be creative with this and not so focused on production, and just like be in the experimental beginner's mind part of it.
Yeah
without such pressure of a long warp.
Yeah
I hear that. Do you use it to do like sampling at all?
No, I don't.
How do you do sampling?
So I have a couple of different sized warp sectional beams, right? And one of them, most of them are like a yard and a half, I guess, but I have a couple that are a yard. And I will just warp up like 6 inches. You know, 3 sections, 4 sections in the middle, and do it that way.
Cool. Yeah, that's a good way to do it too. I'm a big fan of, we've had issues in the past.
You're a big fan of sampling on the loom.
That you're going to weave on.
That you're going to weave on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I don't have different reed sizes for the smaller loom. So I couldn't actually replicate what I'm trying to achieve on it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That becomes a whole other thing too. If you're not denting it the same and you get, read marks and all that, things get weird and track and I hear you there.
It's definitely, it took a lot of learning, because I would just go sample on my little jack loom before I would go to my big jack loom, and I would realize that the pressure is totally different from the reed on both of them, and the way the harnesses would lift were different because I was using two different types of looms, and it was just so now I just, if I'm going to use that loom, I sample on that loom. And it's made a big difference.
Yeah, it has.
And you guys have like auto advanced mechanisms and stuff on your ADLs and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like I've never had to deal with like the pressure of, you know, the reed, and there's so many like technical things that that develop your proficiency as a weaver that I haven't had to experience.
Yeah, you'll get there.
I'm excited for it. I would like to be feel more well-rounded.
Yeah.
In my skills.
It is very interesting learning on an AVL. I mean, that's a really kind of cool, interesting thing. At least to, you know, because you don't talk to, I mean, who has that opportunity to go from like not weaving to learning on an AVL and being, that's what you get to weave on. I mean, it's like you get every bell and whistle.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like learning how to drive on a Ferrari or something. Right.
Yeah. And then you go drive like some dumpy old Chevy or something, you know, and you have to grind the gears to get it in.
So why do you choose to use the mechanical dobby on your loom versus using a compu dobby?
Ooh, yeah.
That's a good question. Because I'm a purist.
Totally cool.
I think, well, I'm kind of a Luddite to begin with. I'm not super tech savvy. I'm getting better, as we all have been forced to. But, Blossom, part of the story that sold Blossom's product was that he lived in an off-grid yurt and produced these garments without electricity for the most part. And that's part of the story that I, want to hold on to.
Cool. That's a good reason.
Yeah.
I think, like, not that you need a reason, you make the work that you want to make and how you want to make it. But I think having that story and having that connection with people is important. Mm-hmm. And especially like if they're going to share this garment with somebody else to share the story, they're like, this wasn't made with any electricity or like hardly any electricity. Like, how cool is that?
Mm-hmm.
You can hardly say that about any of our clothes now.
Totally. Yeah. And it'll come in handy in the apocalypse. So
yes,
that's right. That's why we have all the mechanical doggy heads for all of our looms.
Yeah. And I love it. I love the technology of it. It's just so cool to me.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, it is a computer in itself. So why would you have to like improve upon it? But
yeah. And you know, there's like getting into debates about how, like, are you really hand weaving it if there's a computer helping you?
That's where I was going to go with that conversation.
Yeah.
That
I
was
I know, but it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you run into people at shows and then they're like, you can see that wheel turning in their head. So it's kind of nice that you can just like not even have to worry about that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you're designing your patterns, do you just always use the same pattern and what you primarily change is the color?
Yes. Yeah. Blossom developed his own pattern and that is the pattern that I've been using.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. And then with the sampling that I've been doing, that was a challenge that I guess ran into. What am I trying to say? Sampling took forever because I was changing all of the variables all of the time for like each different iteration. And I was like, oh, this is why I use the same pattern for everything. Cool, got it. Check.
I know we had... we have one of our looms, the Dobby's dead on, and I've spent many a night upstairs sitting on the couch unpegging and repegging and unpegging and repegging.
Yeah.
I feel your pain there. Because this one can't do two weavings the same pattern to save her life.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's so many things to explore.
Right.
That's right.
I get bored.
I can't blame her.
Sure.
The only structure that I am willing to do over and over again is a herringbone twill.
Mm.
As
classic.
As boring as it is, you can do so much with the striping and the color work and with that structure. And it's just so interesting to play with like the dynamic of the twill line.
Totally.
That's one that I'm okay with doing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But most everything else, I'm like, all right, that was cool. Let's do another.
Conquered. On to the next.
Yep. On to the next one.
Yeah. I have to say, I really like not herringbone, but where they meet. Chevrons.
You like a pointed twill.
Yeah. I just like zigzags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want your line broken.
Right.
Mm.
I don't know why. I just like the order of it, I think.
Yeah. I get it. It's very geometric, very...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like goose eyes, too.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for a good goose eye.
Yeah. Totally.
So, what kind of structures are you going to explore with your new work?
The one that I've liked the most, is like a, I guess the book that I'm using calls it a netting. But it's a very tight netting. And I'm using bamboo as the weft. And so when it wet finishes, it folds out quite a bit. And gives the sort of like openness of the weave gives it a really beautiful drape.
Nice.
I'm really into. Yeah.
Do you primarily use plant-based fiber?
Yeah.
Is that because of the accessibility of it, or is that just what you choose to work with?
You know, that was what I was given to work with. Mm-hmm. There is a reason why I don't really work with wool, but I don't know if I can articulate it right now.
That's okay.
I mean, I live in, I live sort of on the edge of like two different like bioregions, right? Like I live like between like the Bay Area, Northern California, bioregion and the Pacific Northwest, right? And the Pacific Northwest is very like wool centric. And so I've felt an aversion, I guess, to making my work wool centric.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I don't know why.
That's okay.
I'm kind of a contrarian sometimes. So, but it seems like, the last time that I checked in with my yarn supplier was for the mill ends. He was telling me that the availability of the like fine cotton mill ends is dwindling, but that he does have a large supply of wool. So that it might change at some point, and might end up doing like merino. And I'm like, if I'm moving into wearables, like wool seems challenging unless I'm going to go like cashmere or something real luxury.
just go all in.
I don't have a market for that yet, so we'll get there.
Yeah.
Slowly build it.
Yeah.
Do you use any sort of non-natural fibers?
Mm-mm. No, and I won't.
I like it.
Yeah.
We're the same way. We use all natural materials.
Yeah.
I just don't feel, I can't connect with synthetics.
Mm.
Like, I don't have that same bond when I'm working with them. It's like, oh, I'm just making a thing instead of like creating something that I feel is part of me.
Mm-hmm. And part of the earth and part of someone else and part of.
Yeah.
I mean, I could get down with like some gold, like Lurex or something every once in a while, but.
Yeah. Just a little bit.
You know,
gotta have just some sparkle. A little
hint of glitter somewhere.
You know, I think that's an interesting point. I think that there are, every now and then, there comes a material that could be interesting to work with. You know? Like, I feel like I could throw, well, see, but then it goes back to, like, a natural material, right? Because I feel like I could throw metal into my rugs, like copper wire or something like that would be cool in a rug.
Sure.
But yeah, I guess I just end up back with natural materials.
Yeah. It's hard. Oh, this is, I guess, something that I wanted to bring into this conversation. This would be a good segue to it. But like, as a queer person and like being like in queer community, the queer aesthetic is not, does not lean towards natural or like natural dyes or natural colors, or, you know, it's very bright or glittery, or
it's very loud, very in your face. Yeah.
Yes. Or yeah, anyway, so what did I want to connect with that? Oh, like feeling like connected to my community and creating a product that like my community can connect to sometimes feels not quite there. Sorry, I'm losing my words.
Yeah, no, I get it though, because it's hard to, there's a point where you feel like you are creating a body of work and you want it to connect with members of your community because that's important to you.
And people who I connect with, yeah.
And the people that you connect with. And so you want them to feel the same joy that you have about your work.
Yeah.
So I definitely understand that challenge of being, having your voice as an individual connect with the voices and interests of your community. It's kind of like a, sometimes it's a dichotomy and sometimes it's very unified. So I definitely can feel and understand that struggle.
Cool. Thanks for putting the words to that.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Sometimes with the work that I do, either within or outside of weaving, I feel like the people that I would actually care to be interested in the work that I do, just they don't have any interest at all. They don't, you know, they like me fine, but, you know, they just don't, no interest at all. And, or understanding, really, you know, like, oh, that's nice. You like my computers do things, you know, when really what I'm doing is like crazy complex and difficult to do. And it's taken me years to figure out how to do it. And I get excited about it, you know, and, you know, people are just like, that's nice. I feel like, that has happened to us with weaving.
Yeah.
You know, people, I think, until we were starting to get into shows like American Craft Show, that people outside of the craft community recognize as good shows, people were like, oh, that's cute. You guys weave. Like that, you know, that's fun. I'm glad you have a hobby. Yeah, I feel like, I don't know. Yeah, it can be hard.
Yeah.
And, yeah, also, and I think that like class also plays into that also, because what you were saying at the beginning, like my people can barely afford the things that I make, you know, and so it's challenging to like be making things for like an audience that I don't often connect with or can't have a hard time finding connecting points with, and even sometimes might even feel contempt for.
Yeah. So do you, okay. So this gets into a different thing.
Okay.
That I feel is somewhat related and I'm very interested to hear your take on it. Now, when you're thinking about pricing and you're thinking about the people you want to buy your product versus the people who do buy your product, do you think about pricing in a way to try to make it available more to the people that you want to buy your product? Or do you make it, do you price it so that the people who do buy your product, it's priced properly for those people? Does that make sense?
Both. Yeah. My answer is both. Okay. I don't pay myself. My retail prices don't pay me less than $20 an hour. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like at the very least I'm worth $20 an hour.
For sure.
And I would say that there are people who are going to buy it, won't bat an eye at a $25 or $50 difference in price.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows me to offer reduced rates for people in my community and my friends and my family.
There it is.
That's
awesome. Yes. I am a fan of, and I've had this discussion with a friend of mine who is an artist. Mm-hmm. And also Lily Marsh, who was in an early episode of the podcast. We talk about this. And I am a big fan of accessibility of weaving.
Yeah.
And while fairly pricing it for us, in a way that we can pay our bills, I kind of feel like, and I know this, I don't know how to like say some of these things without seeming like a D-bag, but I kind of don't care what I make as long as I can pay my bills. And I know that that may be shitty to hear for some people, because it also may not be great for the overall weaving market.
Sure.
Because I don't want to devalue somebody else's work.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's right. Definitely
not what
I'm trying to do.
It's the responsibility of all of us to maintain
integrity. Yeah, I'm trying to price product at a point where people who can afford it can buy the product without worrying about it, much like you said.
Right.
They just grab a couple towels, grab a blanket, and they're on with their day.
Yeah.
And they feel happy with the product that they bought for the price that they bought it. And I feel good because that product that brought me
income,
mm-hmm. you know, right. and I didn't undercut, you know, the person six booths down from me who also is slaving away at their loom and ruining their knees and backs, to do this because they love it. But I'm also concerned that if we don't get middle-class families with hand wovens and handmade things in their lives, then how do we increase awareness? How do we get more middle class families with those sorts of things and drive that market and get the awareness of the value of having something like that in your life?
Yeah.
And getting the community around me to see that, and then hopefully the community around me, and so on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a hard thing to do, and I love how you're doing it.
Well, thanks. I mean, of my peer group, you know, I don't have a lot of other maker friends, like, in my peer group. You know, like, I've made other maker friends throughout this process, but, like, in my core group, and then, you know, there are people who do make things, and they're much lower on the price point scale, and they aren't weavers. And anyway, so it's been shocking for a number of people of my friends and closer community to be like, whoa, you charge how much for what? You know, and to feel a lot of judgment about that from them, because I run in radical anti-capitalist circles. And also part of my work that I've done around that is through like educating about the process, right, of course, and also shifting the doing a reframe around like what it means to invest in things that are going to last a decade or more or whatever, what it means to like save up for a thing that is an investment in yourself and also in your community and your friends and your loved ones.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that is a huge part of how we price as well, because I don't necessarily think that we price too low for the market that we're in and the things that we make, especially when you consider the fact that what we're making, I mean, it's in the name of our business, Comfort Cloth Weaving. You know, we're making material that you should feel comforted by for the rest of your life and then the rest of your kids' lives. Right. And then the rest of their kids' lives. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're making it out of high quality material that costs us a lot of money to buy. You know, we source that material specifically so that when you buy something from us, it may, you know, like to our friends as well, that they're like, for a hand towel, you know, like that's going to go in my kitchen and it's going to wipe up spaghetti sauce.
Yeah.
You know, and we're like, yes, put it in your kitchen, use it, take care of it. You'll have it forever. And I mean, if they can survive our kitchen, they can survive any kitchen. But, you know, for someone at a show who understands that, and we're not having to do the education so much, they're like, oh, wow, for a hand towel, I'll get two.
Yeah, right. Totally.
You know? But then that allows us to sell to them and then, you know, give a couple away at Christmas and, you know, bro-rate it for a couple of friends who really just have been admiring them for years, but just can't afford it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then it makes you feel good because you're like, you're the love that you put into that product, you're able to like really
give
to somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. And there's so much more gratitude, I think, also on the end of the people who are you're passing that onto. You know, like, and a deeper appreciation, I think, also. That's been my experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. Especially when they know what goes into it.
Yeah. When they have that deep appreciation and they just don't have the funds.
Yeah.
Like, you can see that. And I'm like, I want this magic to be in your life, obviously.
Yes.
Right.
Because I wish all my customers were like you.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. If all my customers were like you, then I would just have no money and I'd just be running a charity. Yeah.
But it's a charity based in gratitude and appreciation.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Totally fulfilling.
Yes. For sure. Yeah. That's, we have a jeweler friend, and her and I trade work. I work on her website and do her tech stuff for her, and then she offers almost, well, not this year because she, you know, this year's been crazy, but most years we swap work, website work, for a reduced rate on jewelry that there's no way that I could ever afford.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those pieces of jewelry are like my talismans. Like when I need to feel powerful or when I need to feel like I'm in control, those are the pieces that I put on and I just feel amazing.
Yeah.
So it's like the fact that I'm able to share that with her is such a huge deal to me, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to afford her work. And this way I can promote her work, and I still get to have that same like good feeling, like I am the warrior goddess.
But you know, too, the other thing about that is like, even if you're not like on our end, right? You know, we have lots of friends who are makers and who do that kind of stuff, but you know, we have also lots of friends who aren't. And if we give them something, the idea is not like we're just in the mindset of promoting our friends, right? I mean, it's like,
for sure.
You know, we understand the amount of work, just like you do, you know, that goes into like all of this making by hand and the love and the energy and sleepless nights and, oh my God, I, you know, have to pay my mortgage and the rent on the thing and the this and the that. And so we promote that. But even if you don't have to do that, and you can just give somebody something and they get everything that you just said out of it and they don't promote it. That is the feeling that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just the fact that they like walk into their kitchen mm-hmm. and they see that hand towel, or they get up in the morning and they put, you know, put mm-hmm. an article of clothing that you made on and it just like makes their day.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
It's just that feeling. It's like, you know, so like inside of you, you get like a little something in the morning. When definitely. Somebody out there feels your work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like thinking about Dave Navarro, I'm going to go back to that because it's just so.
That's please, so yes. special. That's so,
so
cool.
mind blowing to me. But like, I see his like social media and he is literally like living in these things.
That's so cool.
It feels good, right? You put all that energy in and
you
to know that it's that your energy means something on the other end.
Yeah. That people can feel it. That like it is like a validation that magic is real.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
I mean, I'm a witch and I know this through like other experiences, but like through this type of, it's just another validation. Yeah.
Okay. So that just brought up, I mean, now I've got another hour okay. of questions, but I'll keep it tight. right. I don't know if you have, listened at all, but we had, Anne
Fernway.
She explained how to say it and I still can't get it right. Fernway.
Anyway,
yes.
She is
a few episodes ago and okay.
She's witchcraft on Instagram, craft craeft, and she is a fiber witch.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which
so,
is really cool.
I mean, the conversation was so cool and enlightening to me. Uh-huh. What elements of the magic do you use in your work?
Well, I'm more of a like hearth witch kind of person. Mm-hmm. I'm less of like a big ritual high priestess kind of woo woo kind of witch. I have done that kind of magic and stuff before. And that is sort of like the sort of spiritual communities that I was referencing to.
Okay.
But most of what I identify with magic is intention, visualization, manifestation. These like really tangible, accessible pieces of like shifting energy in the world.
Yeah.
That anyone can do, right? And so when I'm working, well, okay, so pretty sure Blossom put a spell in the pattern. Just gonna start with that.
nice.
He hasn't totally divulged that to me, but pretty sure. And I trust his magic. but most of what I do is around that. Is like in putting intention, putting like you know, I try not to work when I'm like frustrated or even though, you know, obviously that happens sometimes, but like, clearing the vessel, you know, kind of thing. So that there's like a channel and I listen to great music and I try to just like be as openly myself and bringing my like essence through into like what I'm touching.
Cool.
That would probably be the most basic explanation. I don't like do big spells or, you know, whatever. And like, sometimes maybe I'll like pay attention to whatever like astrological or lunar stuff is happening. But I, as like a person who's done witchcraft for a long time, I feel like kind of weird about how it's blown up on social media now. And I definitely could have like taken the road of like capitalizing on that. And then in my contrarian ways, I just go the opposite and I don't talk about it at all. But people feel it, and that's,
That's awesome. So, do you think it comes into play with the colors that you choose?
Or definitely.
Okay.
Or like when I'm when I'm doing the color, designing the color and like warping this like really intricate color situation, like all like systems are firing, you know what I mean? Like all the little sparkly bits are like firing off. And that is the magic, right? And it's,
cool.
That's awesome.
I am slowly learning and teaching myself about witchcraft because I've always been interested, and it's just, I've always felt a draw to it and connection to it. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to start being more intentional about what I do. And instead, so I ended up, this last blanket design I did, I ended up using some numerology in the stripes to like help promote like prosperity and good health, because I knew it was going to like this farmer's families, like family members. So I wanted to be like, I want to help promote that like good wishes and good 100% hope for the future.
Love it.
So I think it may not necessarily be like going all in and changing how I operate, but just like being more intentional and being more connected with the work is kind of changing how I'm approaching the business.
Small tweaks.
Small tweaks.
Yeah. I mean, small changes is where it's how you build a foundation.
Yeah.
So do you think that what you put into your work in this regard, whether or not people that are buying your work or happening into your booth or happening upon your work, do you think that people on some level can feel the intention 100%. And all that you've put in, whether or not they know?
100%.
Yeah. And that they're drawn to certain pieces over others and things like that. Yeah.
Cool.
That's very cool. Yeah. Because I feel like that a little bit for our stuff. I mean, we're not doing the same thing you're doing, but I do feel that certain people come in and you can kind of tell that like that person definitely is going towards the blankets, and they're drawn to this thing much more than they're drawn to something else. And I don't know why that is. I don't have any, you know, basis to think about, sort of why that might be. Where you're much more intentional about lots of things that you're doing. In the past, we have just sort of been designing to the best of our ability based on our customer base and, you know, problems we give ourselves to solve. That's so cool.
Totally.
Cool. So
Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Say, continue.
Oh, I just like the different types of connections that I have with my customers is the feedback that I have to say with certainty.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. Not all of my customers, obviously, but like, whoopsies. But I would say that, you know, on average at a show, I'll have those kinds of connections with customers, maybe like 75% of the time, something more than half, you know,
like that's cool.
A measurable difference.
That's cool. Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, it's rare when I have a customer that's just like, oh, ho hum. Yes, I need a scarf for my wife. I'll take this one. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, right. there is something there. And people are like, ooh, what's this? I'm like, oh, tell me about that. You know,
mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love those customers.
They're my favorite.
Me too.
Me too.
When we were at, here we are reminiscing about shows, right? When we were at ACC Baltimore the first year, we had, I don't know. Tegan, had, I think, one too many glasses of wine one night and then just applied for like full booths at every show she ever wanted to go to. And then we got into every single one but one.
I was really confident. And I was like, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, why not?
The worst thing, no.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So we get into ACC with a full 10x10 booth the first year. And we're kind of shitting our pants, to be honest. And so we get there, and because we're a full booth and first year, we get like this blue bar.
Special banner.
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
And so then the first day is like everybody, actually the first 2 days, right?
Yeah.
Everybody, nobody bought anything. Everybody just came to talk to us. They wanted to like learn about us, talk to us, see what we had, all that kind of stuff. And there was this couple, and they came in and they planted themselves. One of them had it was a wheelchair that had like a little motor thing on it. And then the other one had like a pop out like tripod chair. Nice. And they came in and they were like, we're here to chat.
Wow.
And they chatted for like 45 minutes. It was so awesome. And they were educated about weaving, so we could like really actually talk to them.
Yeah, have a real conversation about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
And I forget where I was going with that. I think it was just awesome customers.
Yeah.
But that first year was so cool because it was unlike any experience either of us had ever had before.
Yeah.
Where people were educated and interested.
Cool. Did you also make sales?
The final day.
It was insane.
The final day, everyone who had come came back.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Cool.
And they were like, all right, we see you still got this stuff. We're going to take this, this, and this. And I'm like,
awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a little scary. That was the show that we learned the biggest lesson I think we've ever learned about shows was don't judge a show until you're on the way home.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and then
totally.
The second biggest lesson came a year later when it was don't judge a show until 6 months after, when all the people who are bummed that they didn't buy something get a hold of you and buy that thing.
Cool.
Yeah. So we're at the point of the podcast where we ask our final two questions.
I know, you know, we haven't been asking and I kind of liked it, but we'll go back to asking.
I like them. I think they're interesting.
I know.
So the first one I'll have Eric ask. I'll
do it. Okay.
You got the sheet, right?
I do. It's you right ready in front of me because I took notes.
So my question is a big mistake you've made and like what you learned from it or how you got through it or...
That one wasn't on the list.
Oh, it wasn't?
Oh.
It's not on the list?
A big mistake that I've made.
Yeah. Just like either in weaving or in the business.
Yeah. No, I'm... Where do I start?
I know. Well, that's the thing. There's so many, right? Us too. Want one from me while you're thinking?
Well, I think I got it. I think I'm looking at it right now, actually.
Okay, excellent. Let's hear it.
So at that first ACC show, my first show ever, I got this wholesale account, right? And Blossom had told me probably day one about doing custom work. And he was like, if they don't want to buy, you know, minimum orders 20 yards or whatever, if you're going to do... Or 100 yards. It was some absurd number that no one would ever say yes to.
Right.
Probably. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Of course. And then I get this wholesale order and she's like, you know, the woman who's buying from me is this like, she owns this like really avant-garde boutique in where Palo Alto, you know, just okay. like where Stanford is, like very, very high end. You know, she's like, oh, but I love this red. And it was like this colorway that went from like orange to like purplish pink. She's like, but I don't think our customers are going to really like the pink. Could you do it more in just like the like red to orange range? And I was like, yeah, of course, totally. Yep. And she only bought like 6 pieces probably. And which felt like a lot at the time. And I then, it was probably the first warp that I did without Blossom's guidance. And it's gorgeous, you know, it's beautiful. It's like dark red on the edges and it's like a orangier in the middle. It's a very subtle color change. And I warped probably 200 yards of it. And I am going to be weaving it for like the next 5 years.
Oh, man.
It doesn't, like, the pink to orange vibrant thing that Blossom's original design was sold like hotcake. Like, people, like, he couldn't weave it fast enough. Like, people just loved it. Right. And there's just, like, something about this that doesn't pop the same way. And it just doesn't move. And
that's the thing about color. Sometimes it's hard. Nice
advice. Yeah. One against the advice.
So my question is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Well, there's that good one for Blossom about custom work.
Yeah.
I did like that question. It was number one. There's a phrase that goes through my head a lot that also comes from Blossom, and it came from his teacher, and it's something like a thread under tension is a thread under control. And apparently his mentor used to say it a lot, and his mentor was very German, and so it goes through my head in a very thick German accent that I will not try to reproduce right now for you. Save myself that embarrassment. And also knowing your worth and pricing your work accordingly.
That's hard. I think we've talked to seasoned weavers that are still like trying to figure it out.
Cool.
Yeah, and I mean, I think as a new weaver whose work is priced very high, it's been a challenge. You know, because I'm just like, I don't actually know what my worth is.
Well, I think, too...
That's maybe not the right phrase.
What I was going to say is it's hard when you're new at anything. I mean, I don't think that this is a weaving specific topic.
Sure.
But when you're new at anything, I think it's hard to price at what the thing that you're making should be priced at, because 100%. People, like, one of the bigger problems is, well, one of them is like, it's hard to market, right? But the other one is that you don't have that track record.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who's been doing this for 20 years can say, like, look at all that stuff I've made.
Yeah.
Like, you don't think that this is worth that when I've got this giant collection of work out in the world?
That shows a lot of range.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, like, I have a huge body of work, but there's, like, very little range in it.
I mean, it's hard, right, to sort of, in other people's eyes, sometimes justify it. Especially if somebody's, like, looking for a deal. I mean, I think that the biggest thing that, like, we have two policies at shows. One is no trades, and the other one is we don't bargain. And unless we really want it or we're actually friends with the person, and then we can do it not at a show.
Right.
But we have to reach friendship to to do that with someone.
Right. Totally.
And I think that those two things have made us feel much better about our pricing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not giving breaks to people. We don't price our stuff high and then give breaks. Mm. We decide what it's going to cost. And yeah. then people pay that price. Or they don't buy it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do, like, I offer an incentive for joining my mailing list.
Oh, nice.
As far as, like, a discount goes, which I realized was too high. So I've since lowered it. Mm-hmm. And that feels great, too. Because I noticed that, like, people don't always take advantage of it either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, even people who are buying stuff, they're like, I don't really want to be on your mailing list. I will pay full price. And I'm like, oh, okay, great.
Also, I mean, that is a really smart thing to do. Something that we do is if we're demoing at a show, we'll give away like 3 scarves or something.
Whoa.
And sign up for the email.
Wait, you guys
list.
Actually take a loom to a show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Y'all are nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just, we're not the smartest people if in relation to the things we do to our bodies.
Are you bringing, like, a full trailer and stuff? Or
well,
like...
we've got a full-size van. And
sure.
We can pack it so the doors just close.
Okay.
And yeah. We're up front, and yeah. Everything else is just in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if we need to, we do have a trailer that we can bring in. We have in the past.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm still doing shows out of my Kia Soul. And I can fit a whole booth in my Kia Soul, which
yeah.
I'm pretty
yeah.
proud of.
That is some engineering. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. On that note.
On that crazy ass yeah. note.
Hey.
I hope you have a great day. And
hey, thanks.
Yeah. I can't wait to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks.
Have a great day.
See you
day.
On the internet. See you, yeah, bye.
Bye. I'm so excited to see what she comes up with.
Yeah, that was a really fun conversation. Another thank you goes out to Rawhead the Recluse for providing music for our podcast. Find him at rawheadtherecluse.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe now. It will help us reach more weavers and people who are passionate about hand-created textiles.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Professional Weaver Society, and you can get full show notes at proweaverpod.com.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Professional Weaver Podcast. We look forward to sharing more episodes with you each Friday.
Bye.